The following talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi during a Fusatsu ceremony at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
In a sangha, an Indian master said that a phenomenon upon its arising, this is a klesha, arises with a characteristic of thoroughly disturbing our mind, so that in its arising, the mind stream itself is disturbed, is conflicted. And he said there are different ways in which this manifests when we're in the midst of greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy. It's distracting, right? Those emotions are so strong and powerful, they take our attention. They distract us away from wherever else we might be. They distort. They color our mind. They affect our perceptions in ways that we can all too easily not know, not recognize. And that becomes the reality that we think is true and is present and that we respond to. They agitate. They create an inner turbulence within ourselves, within the mind, the body, our energy. They also, interestingly, make us mentally dull. So at the same time that they're agitated, you can think of how those strong emotions demand so much energy that it's like all of the energy is flowing into that, and the mind becomes dull, lacking in clarity. And in that, we can easily become careless with our words, with our actions, with what we do. And that's based in diminishment of our restraint, our scruples, our sort of, is a kind of intoxication, where in that state we think, say, and do things that we wouldn't, very likely wouldn't, if we were more clear, if we were not distracted, if our view was not distorted, if we weren't agitated, if our mind was not dull, so on. And so teachings say that there are certain conditions that give rise to these afflictions, which should be of great interest to us, right? Like, what are those conditions that create a fertile ground for these afflictions to arise? Because it's not just a matter of willfully, you know, stopping or redirecting or letting go or somehow managing the emotion when it arises. We do need to learn how to practice the emotion when it arises. But better is to get clear about what are the conditions in which it is going to arise, so that we're not just always dealing with it in the moment when, in a way, it's too late, not quite, but it's already arisen, but rather, in a sense, work our way back. And so one condition is spoken of as the basis, and this is the essential sort of existing disposition that exists within all of us towards these various mental and emotional states. And it's taught that in the Yogacara school that these inclinations, these predispositions exist in our deepest consciousness, and that they travel with us through our lives. And in the teaching of rebirth, they travel from one life to the next, which is why how we live this life is so important, whatever the circumstances of our life might be, because that ground within which the basis for these kleshas to arise is traveling through our lives and then beyond in the teaching of rebirth. And that's one of the reasons that in a funeral, for instance, for the funeral for Yukon on Sunday, he will receive the precepts. Having received the precepts, a person who's received the precepts receives them again after they've passed. Because that consciousness within the teaching of rebirth, that consciousness is moving towards its next life, and so the precepts are given again to offer, to, in a sense, endow, if you will, that consciousness. And that the influences that we experience stimulate that latent disposition to become manifest, no longer latent. The next condition that is necessary is there needs to be an object, there needs to be something that we're reacting to, we're responding to. We don't just get angry in a vacuum, right? And it's not just that there are circumstances that might be influencing it, but we're angry about something, or we're angry at someone. We're grasping for something. We're prideful about ourselves. We're jealous of someone else. So there's an object. And that object might be desirable, and so then there's grasping, or it might be undesirable, in which there's aversion and anger. And that although all objects have the same nature, they affect us differently. We respond to them differently. I mean, just think about how in sitting, if every thought you have is made of the same stuff, right? Ultimately, it's empty. It's not fixed. It doesn't live somewhere in a permanent state. It's just energy that appears in the form of a thought, and then it's gone. So if all thoughts are the same, have the same nature, then why do we respond to different thoughts so differently? Some, and we describe them, some are trivial, superficial, unimportant. Some are very significant, important. And so we respond differently, and that brings forth these afflictive emotions. And then there's a social context, right? That we're conditioned, part of the conditions under which we're functioning in every moment, and that we're experiencing, having perceptions, understanding our world, is a social context. Sangha, family, friends, people we work with, people we encounter through media, news, on the streets, strangers. A teacher said, adults recognize the strong influence of peer pressure on children, but seldom take stock of the extent to which their own emotions and behavior are affected by the wish to be a part of a group, the desire not to be seen as strange or different from others. Seeking the approval or praise of people we care about or respect can make us compromise our ethical values if we are not mindful. I don't know how it was for you, but I think of when I was a teenager, right? And the group, the peer group, was all important. You know, and looking back, I think we were each, like in my group of friends, we were each sort of looking at the group and each other for affirmation, but there was no center, right? In a sense, we were all looking for something, right? And doing whatever, oftentimes. I mean, I definitely remember doing things that I thought, this is not right. But all my friends are doing it. This teacher said, if a close friend is upset with someone, we tend to get angry at that person as well. If a family member is strongly attached to a particular political view, our attachment or anger towards it will easily arise. And so it's just talking about, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. We're influenced by our circumstances, by the people around us, by everything we basically take in through our senses. Another condition is spoken of as listening to unskillful or incorrect teachings, which really means anything that is untrue, that is distrustful or just not trustworthy, that is dishonest, deceitful, false, aggressive, hateful. But it's listening to those. It's not just encountering them in the world, but it's actually listening, giving them our attention, It says these glorify the negative traits of our mind. I mean, just think about authoritarians and how they have a message that they convey over and 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 over, right? Until it's part of the mind stream. Habituation. That if we, when these kleshas arise, if we don't practice them, if they go unattended, right, then they proceed as they have, as their habit has formed them to proceed. They do what they do. And they is us, right? We do what we do within that strong emotion. But it's an habitual response. And so that, and in that, which has been formed over many repetitions of like actions, it keeps getting stronger, right? The habit, it keeps getting stronger. And that's why, and they sort of, one teacher said they kind of self-replicate, which is, you know, a little tricky because the emotion is not something that has its own autonomy. But it seems to perpetuate itself in kind, right? So giving rise to anger over and over and over again does not lead to peace. Giving rise to greed over and over and over again does not make us more generous. And that's why when these very strong emotions, these karmic emotions, kleshas arise, in the moment, it's considered so important that we practice them well. Because that moment is a kind of turning moment, right? Well, either if we respond habitually, then they will just continue in the same way and they get stronger. And it gets harder, right? It gets harder to actually not fall into that. It gets harder to shift them when we get around to that. And so when it arises, that's really the kind of auspicious moment that if we practice it well, then it shifts. It has the potential to shift. And when we do that again and again and again and again, so often as students, you know, we bemoan that something keeps rising, we have to keep practicing it. But in this sense, that's a good thing because every time it arises and we practice it, that pathway is getting stronger. And then the last is a distorted attention, or referred to as an inappropriate mentation, so that within the midst of the klesha, the mind is basically is engaged, right? It's thinking about, it's projecting, ruminating, spinning, having opinions. And if we think about these other elements, so the object what we're ruminating about is the person we're angry at, or the thing that we're greedy for. And we're creating worlds and fantasies and plans and strategies. And that's considered an inappropriate mentation. We can do it, right? It is a form of attention, but it's distorted. And in that, the mind expands and exaggerates and fixates. And that's what's called inappropriate mentation, right? We're not using that most powerful, very powerful aspect of our mind in a way that's appropriate, that's helpful. And this is why, beginning with the Buddha, the teachers throughout the ages have encouraged us to avoid environments that contain all of these traps, if you will. Not because oftentimes the situation or the circumstances are in and of themselves bad, but because we struggle, we have a hard time in them. we're struggling, we find that we have a hard time being clear or mindful or practicing well in them. And so there's an emphasis on creating circumstances, going to places, being in an environment that isn't so hard, that doesn't make it so hard, so that we can develop our capacity to encounter objects, which brings forth these underlying dispositions, and so to change, in a sense, the context, the social context, to change, be very careful about what we're listening to continuously practice the habituation. So when we reflect on these conditions, we see how practice, seshin, it's a perfect example, is really perfectly, is like perfectly made, right, to be helping us in these ways. And that when we do get into distorted attention, inappropriate mentation, which happens a lot, but oftentimes when we're in the midst of busyness, we don't notice it so much. When you're stuck here on that cushion and there's nothing else going on, it's hard not to notice, right? And I was reading a teacher who was questioning, you know, is this just an inherent part of, are these afflictions just an inherent part of human nature? Is this just the way we're built and we're stuck with it and, you know, do the best you can? And that from a Buddhist view, that's just not true. It's not even tenable, because not only is it, as this teacher said, a very narrow view of human potential, it's really selling ourselves short on what we're capable of, but also that we understand that there is nothing that is fixed. I mean, if this was an inherent part of human nature, then we're quite literally wasting our time. Then all of the mechanisms of samsara would pretty much be, you know, the solution at hand, which is just mitigate, avoid, build walls, you know, because the thing itself has its own power. The thing within us has its own power, which means it wouldn't be a lot we could do with it other than just, you know, damage control. And that these very subtle aspects of our mind and consciousness are not bound, they're not fixed, they're not determined in any way. And also understanding how, because we live in a physical body, that's part of our environment, right? Not a small part. It's a big part of our environment. And so when we're tired, hungry, stressed, right? Scared. When we can, it can be harder to draw forth on those aspects of our practice that are needed, right? Because we're being affected, we're being influenced by that condition of the physical body in its current state. And so in that, it can be easier to get angry, to be impatient, to get irritated and annoyed when we're feeling tired or hungry or, you know, sort of diminished in some way. On the other hand, when we feel very strong and full, we can be more, you know, get caught in desires of all sorts, right? Because anything seems possible. And that we need to, it's important to be able to see the difference between different thoughts that are helpful, that are not helpful, that are neutral, and that sometimes it's not so easy, that sometimes we confuse, for instance, love and attachment, clinging attachment, grasping attachment. Sometimes it's not clear whether what we're experiencing is confidence or pride. It's not so much a klesha, but having a strong aspiration, sometimes it's hard to be clear, is it an aspiration or is it an expectation? Can we self-reflect without being self-critical? Do we recognize healthy desires, and can we recognize when they shift into greed and grasping? So sometimes it's not so easy to know. But, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And so when those unhelpful elements, when they kind of get mixed in or infiltrate some quality that's actually good, we'll eventually know if we're paying attention, because it'll start to hurt, right? Or somebody else will start to hurt based on our actions. In other words, we'll start to create some unhelpful actions. And that the way we work with these are the fundamental freedom from these kleshas, as realized and taught and confirmed by the Buddha, is to realize their fundamental nature. That they are empty. That no matter how strong, compelling, persistent, seemingly true an emotion is, a thought is, that it has no autonomy, it has no power of its own, it doesn't exist by itself, it's not something that's happening to us. And we can see that. The evidence is not hard to see when you're sitting and something arises and you have aversion, you dislike it, you want to get rid of it, you push it away, you get stronger. You see that. On the other hand, if you like it and you grasp at it, you cling at it, you want to hold on to it, it gets stronger. So that could still seem to suggest that it has its own power and we're just giving it a little boost. But what if you don't do either of those two? Follow either of those two impulses? It dissolves. It begins to disintegrate. It drops away. If it had its own agency, it wouldn't. If it had its own power, it wouldn't. You could do whatever you wanted. You could write a song about it. You give it an award. You invite it to dinner. It would do what it wanted. It would have its own power. It would persist. Because that intrinsic quality is just another word for permanence. So we're seeing all the time that these things that are so afflictive are empty of that most vital aspect, which would be our undoing if it were true. And does undo us in many a moment when it seems true, when it seems to be, have its own power, when it seems to be permanent, when it seems to be fixed. And so both recognizing, even, you know, conceptually, having faith in its emptiness is a beginning of undermining, of freeing those afflictions. Because even though they still have power, we're not completely intoxicated by them. We have a developing understanding there's something else going on here. It isn't just what it appears to be. And then we have, in addition to that, which is the fundamental liberation of all of our suffering, we have a wealth of practices. And so we sit. And so those underlying dispositions that are present within our consciousness, we don't need to be afraid of them. We don't need to wonder, will this emotion arise again? We don't have to worry about that. Right? Because we know that they exist within us, and we are developing our capacity to practice them at the same time that we're, which is the same thing, that we're calming those energies. That when the object appears before us, we practice seeing it without loving or hating it. Without objectifying the object, we begin to reflect on our social context writ large, right? And begin to think about how to bring things together a little bit so that our life is actually working for us as well as it can. We're aware of when we're listening to unskillful, incorrect teachings. It's one thing to hear them and know that they're false. It's another thing to hear them and not know, or to strongly believe they are true. But even if we think that they're not true, we're still hearing them. And that doesn't mean, you know, to close off your ears and not listen. But it means be aware. We are, being sentient means we're influenced. We practice the precepts. We study, how does a Buddha live? How does an enlightened being live? What are the things that we do within samsara that cause the most trouble? The grave precepts. How can we practice those? How can we take that same energy, those same impulses, and essentially enlighten those impulses of the self, of grasping, of clinging, of fear, and transform them into affirming actions? And we don't just study them, but we make commitments to practice them. We take vows. We renew our vows. And when we don't practice the precepts well, we take responsibility. As I've said, and if we don't do that, what are we doing? What are we doing if we're not taking responsibility for ourselves? Because in not taking responsibility for ourselves, we're quite actually disempowering ourselves from being able to help ourselves. We put a lot of attention into learning, hearing the teachings that have come down to us that are part of our everyday liturgy so that we can begin to understand what is a good intention. What is an aspiration that is worthy of being an aspiration? How do I begin to bring that into my practice? We can reflect on all the good that exists in our lives, in the world, in people around us, cultivate gratitude, appreciation, respect. We can reflect on all the things we receive, that we're receiving this week. It's important to reflect on those things, because otherwise we might miss them. We might just think, it's a retreat, it's a shin, I get fed, I get woken up, that's what I paid for. <You know? laughs> I mean, I remember in my early years, you know, Dada Roshi, I mean, I knew he was in the Dokusan room all day. And then as the week went on, I could see that he was getting tired. And I thought, but that's his job. That's his job, right? Well, that caught up with me. Yes, indeed. The more we look, the more we examine, the more we reflect. That's why I think it's so valuable to, you know, not just appreciate, but draw from this deep, deep study of you, of me, of everything that is you. Anything you want to call you has been studied. Essentially, at its ground within the Buddha Dharma, thanks to our ancestors. And so that we can study and begin to understand, what is this, right? What is this person, this human life, this human body, these things that arise that have such power? And the more we begin to understand that, and the conditions and cause and effect, these essential things that the Buddha said, we must study these aspects, because that's what practice is based on. And if we don't really understand, then the danger is that we're just following a rule, which is, in the beginning, pretty much what everybody does. We follow a rule. This is how you sit zazen. This is what you do with your potty. This is what you do with your breath. That's fine. That's fine for a while. But just like any kind of growing up process, we have to understand more and more what we're doing, in a sense, not to take it apart, to analyze it to death, to dissect it and pin it to a board, but so that we can actually understand how everything that we do in practice, everything we're encountering, is expressly designated to help us with these very things. And that they're doing that in a multitude of ways. We're being influenced in a multitude of ways, ways in which in any given moment some we're aware of, and other ways we're not aware of. That we're continuously turning our consciousness towards not just the Dharma, but towards wisdom, towards compassion, towards non-hatred, non-greed, freeing ourselves from jealousy and pride, which means we have to become pretty kind of expert at anger and greed and pride and jealousy. Somebody who's just prideful generally doesn't know much about pride. Somebody who just acts out on anger probably doesn't know very much at all about anger. Not in any intimate way. Does not really know anger in the moment when they're angry. Why? Because we're distracted in our anger. Towards what? Towards the object of our anger. And so then when we really appreciate that, it's not that what we're doing gains more power, but our ability to engage it becomes more powerful because we understand it, we trust it, and in a very real way, we understand more and more how to practice it. So that when we're practicing and we're in a new or difficult or challenging situation, it's not just a matter of trying to remember what did the teaching say, which is fine. That's what we need to do. We need to remember what the teachings say. But more and more, we can know for ourselves what will actually be helpful here because of understanding causation, because of understanding these conditions in which afflictions arise and then don't arise. You know, when I think about so many moments in my early training, I wish if I could just go back and like change that one thing, rethink that particular thought. You know, I think of the delusion, sometimes the deluder is spoken of as the foolish. And I don't always like that translation, but goodness knows, there are many a time when I was foolish. And who knows, maybe still. So let's just sit for a few minutes and then we'll finish with the Fusatsu and finish our evening. We'll do Zazen just a few minutes here on our seats.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.